I'd like to welcome you to another edition of EWI Podcast, where we seek to explore some of today's pressing global issues with today's leading thinkers. As always, you're welcome to check out all of our podcast episodes available on our website, on SoundCloud and on iTunes, all under the name of East West Institute. Today joining me is Elizabeth Ra. Elizabeth is currently a senior consultant at the London headquarters of Control Risks, the global risk consulting firm, and a non-resident fellow with the Atlantic Council's Scowcroft Center for Strategy and Security. She was previously a journalist for the Christian Science Monitor and Newsweek, and is currently a contributor to the Times of London, the Wall Street Journal, Foreign Affairs, Foreign Policy, and other publications focusing on European security. Elizabeth, it's a great pleasure to have you as our guest.
Thank you for having me.
In this episode, Elizabeth and I will be talking about the current state of defense in Europe, European defense integration, and new, or rather old, threats to European security. I want to kick off this discussion with a simple question, deceptively simple, I would say. Why should Europe really care about defense? Why does Europe need a strong military?
Well, it's a question I often get, because people will walk down the street in London or Berlin or Paris or any other city, and they'll say, well, you know, I feel safe here. I may worry about pickpockets or bad weather, but I definitely don't worry about an invasion. So why should we spend tax dollars on a stronger defense? And the answer to that is that there is no invasion imminent, but the security situation is changing, and I don't need to tell you that Russia has been modernizing its armed forces since 2008, and they have very impressive armed forces now. Their soldiers were good before, now they also have very modern equipment, and they have been showing their muscle, as you know, in the region, especially in Ukraine, but also, if I may add, in the Arctic. They haven't done anything aggressive there, but they show their presence. And so in response to that, we don't need to get alarmist about it. A deterrence that keeps that sort of opportunistic adversary away from potentially harming your country because you hadn't prepared, and so you didn't have any sort of front to put up against him to keep him away.
Could you perhaps also go into transnational threats? Europe has been exposed to an ongoing refugee crisis, for example, terrorism, ISIS is still active. Are these also concerns to European security?
Yes, they are, because they affect all of society. And if you look at France and Belgium, you have soldiers patrolling the streets, not against Russians, but against terrorists. And the challenging aspect of terrorism is, of course, that you don't see it. You can live 364 days of the year without noticing any terrorism, and then the terrorist strikes and achieves a significant extent of damage. And the problem is that no open society like ours are open societies can keep every potential ill-doer out. So as a result, a number of countries have turned to the armed forces to essentially provide reassurance among the population that they are not completely exposed to terrorism. In some countries, that would be seen as alarmist. And here in the UK, for example, people don't like seeing soldiers on the street. It's a cultural thing, but that's an additional duty for the armed forces and a very significant threat. And I think if you were to ask most Europeans, they would, in fact, they have in surveys referred to terrorism as the most immediate threat facing them, not Russia.
But my follow-on question to this would be, how do you sell something like that to the European public? And I'm really more talking about the right narrative when it comes to defense or common defense in Europe. What would be the European narrative besides this deterrence component? Do you have any ideas how policymakers and politicians can really inform the European public why they should be spending, or why all this investment should be done on defense issues?
Well, I think if you think of it as an insurance policy, it's very easy to understand, because all of us have some sort of insurance. And it's not that we think that we'll, you know, have an accident tomorrow. It's just something that's good to have for the worst case scenario. And it's like that with the armed forces. They are our insurance policy. And the good thing about countries here in Europe, for example, since that's the subject of our conversation, the good thing about our countries here having their own armed forces is that we don't need to to hope that our allies will help us. We know that we have some sort of capabilities ourselves. Now, I would argue we should have more capabilities, but we are already doing something, and that really counts, because it's very good to have allies, but you can't just say, well, I hope they'll help me, because I really can't get around to installing a lock, as it were, on my door.
Can we perhaps move now into this really fascinating article that you published today in the Frankfurter Allgemeine Zeitung, the German equivalent to the Wall Street Journal, I would say, in the United States, where you talk about an issue that is somewhat overlooked sometimes when you talk about defense integration and defense overall in Europe, and that is logistics. And could you perhaps briefly outline your principal argument in that article? You essentially say that Germany should be made panzer fit, as you called it. What do you exactly mean by that?
Well, so there is this great quote by Einstein who said, nothing happens until something moves. And it's like that with logistics, and particularly with military logistics. So we can't be counting tanks, we can't be counting soldiers, we can't be counting guns. But unless they get to where they need to go, all of that equipment is useless. And that's the situation we have today, where the logistics and the infrastructure is just not in place. Now, NATO and the EU separately and together are addressing the bureaucracy of the logistics by, for example, having their member states cut red tapes when it comes to giving other countries' troops permission to enter their countries. But we are still left with the question of infrastructure. So if you don't have enough bridges that can carry your tanks, your tanks aren't going anywhere. And if you don't have enough rail cars that can carry your tanks, and it, by the way, it's not just your usual rail car, they have to hold several tons. And so if you don't have that, all your investment in this expensive kit is pointless. If I may add, Germany is really the central country in NATO, geographically and as a result also logistically, because so many soldiers have to pass through Germany or are based in Germany. Lots of American soldiers are based in Germany. And all of those troops have to pass through Germany to get to the final destination, which, if we look at the current threat scenario, is most likely in the eastern part of Europe. So Germany is crucial, and that's why Ben Hodges, the former commander of U.S. Army Europe, and I argued in this piece that an area where Germany can make a huge difference to NATO is in infrastructure.
So I wanted to ask you, within this context, do you think that something like PESCO could ever actually replace NATO as the principal pivot around which European defense will be developed in the near future?
No, I don't think so. And of course, now is a bad time to say that the U.S. is needed in Europe, specifically in European security, but it is the reality that U.S. armed forces are a very strong contributor to our security. And by the way, there haven't been any cuts in the U.S. military presence here in Europe since Trump took office. A bit paradoxically, it may seem, but the U.S. has stayed the course so far in its military presence here in Europe. And even if we Europeans increase our defense spending, the U.S. will be an indispensable ally in our security. And you can see that, by the way, in how a number of European countries are trying to strengthen their ties to the U.S., essentially out of fear that if the EU somehow develops into a stronger military alliance, that the U.S. will say, well, have at it, you know, mission accomplished as far as we're concerned. And that's a very big fear. So Central and Eastern European countries are very intent on strengthening their bilateral ties with the U.S. And by the way, just a few days ago, you probably saw Sweden and Finland signed a trilateral agreement with the U.S., defense agreement, that links the three countries closer together as well. And of course, Sweden and Finland are not members of NATO. So that's their way of bringing the U.S. closer to them.
If we focus so much on Russia as a threat, I think, first of all, we would have to establish whether Russia actually has any aggressive intentions. If I think back to the 1950s and this whole idea of deterrence, modern deterrent theory was essentially established based on a false premise, that was that the Soviet Union actually in the 1950s and 60s and even in the 70s had an intention to overrun Europe and eventually absorb the entire European continent and bring it under communist rule, which, as it turned out, was not really the case. So I guess you have to labor under the assumption that Russia indeed has aggressive intentions and that it has these aggressive intentions and tries to push it with conventional forces. Do you think this could actually trigger a new arms race in Europe? This idea now that European countries are starting to spend again on defense, Russia is rearming. Having said that, I've seen that Russia's defense budget has declined, but that has more to do with economic reasons probably, not so much with its overall strategy or ambition. So what do you think the chances are that we are entering a new conventional arms race, at least in Europe?
Well, I think it is a danger, and it's a danger that's related to seeing a Russian threat in everything. And it's unfortunately, it's also a bit opportunistic, especially in newspaper articles where editors know that if you put Russia and aggression and Putin aggression in the headline, it will generate a lot of clicks. And so we have this continuous cycle of Russian aggression in the news cycle. And that's unhealthy, I think, because we don't need to imagine Russian aggression, so Russian tanks rolling into the Baltic states. What we could instead focus on is what's happening at the moment, which is the hybrid warfare that you mentioned, so Russian propaganda weakening our societies. And it's not something that we then have to warn people that it may happen. It's already happening, and they can see it for themselves. And so it's something that we need to address, I think, robustly, so as not to weaken our civil societies. Because I think that the big threat with hybrid warfare and the propaganda that comes with it is that our societies lose faith in our institutions that have taken decades, even generations, to build up. And I'm speaking here of Western Europe or the Western world in general. And it has been decades of very hard work. And it would be a great loss if parts of our population would lose faith in those institutions. And by that, I mean the government here in the UK, for example, National Health Service, large companies, for example, or government agencies. And if you look at Russian propaganda, those are some of the institutions that have been targeted.
Do you think that President Trump's repeated calls for an increase in defense spending in Europe has made a difference, or has it been counterproductive in Europe?
It has definitely been counterproductive. I mean, which European leader, even if he or she agreed with Trump that their country needed to spend more, they would just not do it because their public would say, oh, you know, you're a Trump stooge. Look at that, you know, we have even lost our independence. Does Trump dictate our defense policy these days and our national spending? And so that's why it's so counterproductive. But if you look at a country like Germany, for example, that Trump constantly criticizes, there is a potential for more spending, defense spending in Germany. If you look at the annual poll by the Center for Military History and Social Sciences in Potsdam, the most recent poll from 2017 showed that 91% of Germans want the Bundeswehr to defend the country, and it went down the lower percentages from there. But the only mission that only has minority support among Germans is missions in conflict zones, so essentially expeditionary warfare in parts of the world that are continually plagued by conflict. And that's something that is winding down anyway. Afghanistan is winding down. What we're focusing now on is territorial defense. So even in Germany, you have huge support for territorial defense. And so I think if reasonable voices in the U.S. not associated with the government, so that would essentially be former generals, if they were to sort of make the case to, in this case, the German public, that really, you know, it would be so beneficial for the alliance and for your own country if you were to spend more on defense, not to please the U.S. or any other foreign country, but because it serves everybody's interest.
Following up on that question, there are some differences in interests between the United States and Europe, of course, and perhaps you can briefly touch upon why, for example, the United States has always been more hostile to EU defense integration rather than the activities of its European allies within NATO.
Well, it's a very good question, and I think it comes down to the the grandiosity that Europeans, we Europeans, have usually gone about our defense initiatives. So starting with the quote-unquote European army that was the plan in the 1950s, and now all the way up to PESCO, where the initial idea as promoted by France was something much more ambitious than we got in the end. It would be much more limited number of countries participating, and small groups of eligible like-minded states would pursue defense cooperation. Now, that's a whole lot different than a medical command, which is essentially what we got, in addition to a number of logistics hubs. And so if I, as an American, were to hear that, and when the Americans heard that, both with PESCO and during previous attempts at European defense integration, of course, the immediate concern is, all right, so you're going to do defense on your own and possibly shut our defense companies out of the equation. And if you want to pursue strategic autonomy as part of it, that's clearly the intention. So, you know, have at it, and we'll spend our money on other allies. So I think it's a cultural thing where, if Europe is very ambitious in defense, it looks like, you know, it wants to have its own club, and it makes the U.S. less indispensable. So it's understandable, whereas in NATO there is no question that the U.S. is the leading lady, and its role in NATO will just never be questioned.
You just mentioned this idea of strategic autonomy, a concept that has everyone who works in the defense field has heard multiple times, and perhaps we can maybe elaborate on that a little bit. Essentially, Europe is conventionally capable of autonomy, but also in a nuclear way, right? That is, that should Europe be genuinely strategic autonomous, it would also have to get its own nuclear deterrent. And what are your thoughts on that? Do you think that's ever going to be feasible? I know there have been lots of discussions over the last 2 years on the subject, and I think it's something that is really important given the nuclear arms race that is occurring at the moment.
Yes, it has been discussed a lot, and there are, of course, a number of different definitions of what that strategic autonomy would entail and which areas it would be. But, for example, looking at one area, which is defense industry. So France has been pushing this idea for a long time, and did so initially with PESCO until it was diluted and France essentially lost interest. France has been pushing this idea that we, i.e. the EU, should have strategic autonomy in our defense industries. And as you know, the situation right now is that we have a multitude of defense companies who compete against each other, and usually they lose contracts to American companies because those American companies have economies of scale. And so it's a good idea that we should consolidate. But to my mind, looking at strategic autonomy in the area of defense industry is just not going to work, because I think the defense industry will be able to consolidate on its own and driven by market demands rather than by politics or by policies. And it also has the effect, if you push strategic autonomy in the defense industry, has the effect of alienating the U.S. And so what the risk is that we end up alienating the U.S. while still not achieving strategic autonomy in this case, the defense industry, because it's just very hard to get companies and industry, or the industry, to consolidate through political decisions. Now, when it comes to other areas of strategic autonomy, I wonder what the immediate need is for strategic autonomy. And I understand that with a president as unpredictable as Trump, there would be some sort of reassurance in knowing that we can do things ourselves. If worse came to worse, we could fend for ourselves. But still, it has, you know, there are many reasonable voices in American policymaking, or at least a number of reasonable voices, and it would just risk alienating the U.S. for an uncertain outcome, because we don't really know that we would achieve that strategic autonomy. So we would achieve all the negative effects of, i.e., pushing the Americans away while possibly not getting very much out of it as a matter of the capabilities.
Essentially, Europe needs the United States. There's no way around Europe. It also makes me think about those periodic announcements about the death of the Transatlantic Alliance. It happens every 5 years or so. More obituaries have been written on the transatlantic alliance than, I don't know, on the aircraft carrier, right? Also brings to mind Churchill's statement that next to fighting a war without allies, the next worst thing is fighting a war with allies, right? So there are always going to be tensions when it comes to alliance politics, of course. If you could look into a crystal ball, what do you think European security is going to look like in 5 and 10 years from now?
It will look a lot better than it does today because there are a number of procurement projects underway. Countries are becoming serious about readiness. They are doing more exercises. Now, the procurement projects are underway. They will take several years because that's the procurement cycle, but it's happening. And there is also this really quite dramatic realization that we have been complacent. And it's not a surprise that we've been complacent. I think it would have been unreasonable for countries to keep spending Cold War-style money on their armed forces when it looked like Europe was heading in an extremely peaceful direction. So there's lots of improvement underway, especially in countries that are close to Russia. And so, for example, I would urge you to keep a close eye on Sweden and Finland over the next few years, because Finland has maintained very strong armed forces, but its integration with Sweden is impressive. And also, Sweden is becoming much more serious about its armed forces and increasing its capabilities. That includes, for example, the plans of buying Patriots, which incidentally will then strengthen the bilateral ties with the US. So we'll see lots of that. In 5 years, I would also hope that NATO has rediscovered an interest in the southern flank. I shouldn't say it has lost its interest because it does maintain the 360 view, but it is difficult for the southern flank to get enough attention. And I must say, I feel sorry for Italy. The Italian armed forces do an incredible amount around the Mediterranean, essentially being Europe's policeman, both in the Mediterranean, both its navy and its coast guard, and its armed forces in missions in neighboring countries. So we've got more Italian soldiers deployed abroad than German soldiers, which tells you something. But I think and hope that in 5 years, NATO will have come to the aid of the southern flank countries and it's increased its collective mission there, because it's really not very difficult to do.
Before we close the show, I'd like to again thank Elizabeth for her time and sharing her insights on EWI podcast.
Thank you for having me, Franz.
Look for us on our website, SoundCloud and iTunes, under the name of East West Institute, where you can listen, follow, and subscribe so you won't miss our conversations. Thank you for listening.